Reverend Kristen is focusing on climate change, so I'm just going to turn it over to her right now. Thank you.
Good morning. I was sharing with folks before personal theology that I'm on a new allergy medication regimen, so I may have to take breaks and drink water as I'm talking because I'm pretty congested, so I apologize for that ahead of time. It's good to be with you all this morning, and I expect we'll have more people trickle in as the hour goes on. I'm going to be leading worship after this lecture, and the service is actually on the same topic as the lecture. So I will just acknowledge that if you're going to be staying for worship, you're going to hear a lot of the same ideas in the worship service as well. So I'd like to begin now with the words of activist Adrienne Marie Brown, words which I will share again later this morning in worship as a reading. It is hard work to believe in the apparently impossible enough to move towards it. It is terrifying to see another way, especially if it is truly a transformation you see, especially if it begins within you. Then it becomes daily practice, cultivating the seed of a transformed world within. It is generating and sustaining the possibility of liberation, not just for each of us individually, but for a collective body, for a species. Daily practice of that generating and sustaining in the tunnel of justified hopelessness, that is what gives us options, a future. Neither violence nor victory within the current context is as dangerous to those holding unjust power as someone who knows we are free and will continue to move and shape the world accordingly every day. Several weeks ago, wildfires in Australia that had already been burning for about 4 months grew larger than anyone imagined that they could. Images of homeless koalas, desolate red landscapes where once there stood entire communities, and people fleeing the inferno flooded the media. Organizations began to collect donations for everything from hand-knit clothes for animals to cash for direct aid. And then the stories of how those donations were unhelpful or misused began to come out as well. It was hard not to look away. I noticed within myself the desire to avoid coverage of this catastrophe, perhaps because of the wildfires that have been sparked right here in California. Just a few months ago, one jumped a bridge from the North Bay to Crockett, where some of our church members live, and which is only a couple of towns away from where my house is. Many people in my communities have mentioned feeling like this catastrophe happening across the world somehow still feels personal. It feels like something that could happen here to our families and friends. It feels personal in a way that many other catastrophes may not. But it's not just recognizing ourselves in those who are suffering around the world that made this catastrophe and others like it hard to watch. I think scope has something to do with it too. The Australian president refuses to acknowledge the fires are a result of climate change and refuses to consider changing policy to lessen Australia's emissions and other contributions to global warming. He even took a vacation to Hawaii amid the fires. Some individuals, many people here today, are taking the climate crisis very seriously. Unfortunately, governments like Australia's, and of course our own, sure don't seem to be. And when the people that we elected to govern don't seem to care about the suffering of their own people, when they won't use their considerable power to try to curb a problem that is only getting worse, it can be disillusioning. The news cycle has long since moved on, but less than a year ago, flooding caused damage to nearly 60% of American communities and countless farms. And then there's the plastic accumulating in our oceans and the animal extinctions. Every time I read or listen to the news, it seems like humanity's impact on the planet is causing some new problem. But whatever the crisis, some scientists and media have begun to refer to climate change as the new normal, which I guess in some ways is true. But normalizing human-caused catastrophes at this magnitude is itself a scary state of affairs. David Wallace Wells, a climate change journalist, writes these words in Pennsylvania's Intelligencer newspaper. The global response to the Australian bushfires has suggested, unfortunately, that no bind of tribal alliance or allegiance is strong enough that we won't discard it, if discarding it allows us to see the suffering of those living elsewhere on the planet as insignificant to our own lives. These fires are just one disaster, of course, and the planet has many test cases like it ahead. But it would be among the most perverse grotesqueries of climate change if it brought about the end of these kinds of global prejudices, not to be replaced with a sense of common humanity, but a system of disinterest defined instead by ever smaller circles of empathy. Now, I am hardly an expert on solutions to the climate crisis, but I am in the business of empathy and nurturing a common sense of humanity. Our empathy is the reason it is hard not to look away from these catastrophes. We feel for people living through what for us may be unimaginable. We begin to imagine how we would feel in their place. And in a culture that encourages us to avoid bad vibes and only focus on the positives in life, it takes courage to be honest with ourselves and others about how bad the state of the planet really is. It also takes courage to allow ourselves to mourn all that is being lost. Over the last several decades, all kinds of leaders in the fight against climate change have emerged, and most of them seem to have focused on the concrete things that we can do to fix the problem. And human beings like quick fixes. We like top 10 lists that tell us how to reduce plastic packaging from our lives, or checklists of ways that we can reduce our carbon footprint. And those of us engaged with this issue take these lists seriously while also advocating for change at the national level. But I'm becoming more and more convinced that while technical fixes can help, they are important, the path towards shifting human behavior is going to be very different. In 2013, poet and environmental activist Wendell Berry was one of several speakers ahead of a rally on the banks of the Ohio River during that year's General Assembly, which is a business meeting of our Unitarian Universalist Association. And here is what he had to say about the kind of approach that it will take to address climate change. Mountaintop removal and climate change are not the sort of simple problems that can be solved by what we call problem solving. They are summary evils gathered up from innumerable causes in the bad economy that we all depend upon and serve. It is not as though we have not been warned. The advice against waste, extravagance, selfishness, hubris, falsehood, and willful ignorance is old. But people of religion have entrusted questions about economy, about how we live, to economists and industrialists. Environmentalists seem to think that problems caused by technology can be solved or controlled by more technology or alternative technology. People of both kinds seem to think that big problems have big solutions. Both are mistaken. Barry continues, "If we are serious about these big problems, we have got to see that the solutions begin and end with ourselves. Thus, we put an end to our habit of oversimplification. If we want to stop the impoverishment of land and people, we ourselves must be prepared to become poorer. The unlimited use of any energy would be as destructive as unlimited economic growth or any other unlimited force. If we had a limitless supply of free, non-polluting energy, we would use the world up even faster than we are using it up now. If we are not in favor of limiting the use of energy, starting with our own use of it, we are not serious. If we are not in favor of rationing energy, starting with the fossil fuels, we are not serious." Here ends his words. Climate crisis is but one symptom of a larger dominant worldview that frames everything, every place, and everyone, chiefly in terms of how to use them to make a profit. Climate crisis is the result of a worldview that considers the earth an object from which to extract profit rather than a massive system of organisms with whom we evolved to be in symbiotic relationship and without whom we will perish. In other words, this crisis is because humanity has come to relate to the earth as a thing rather than a being that deserves honor and respect. And this crisis is just one of many consequences of unquenchable desire for wealth and power, the same sickness that also threatens to tip our nation into a dictatorship. And yet, passionate efforts to try and bring about large-scale change to the systems that harm us and our planet always seem to be framed as unrealistic or impossible. We are told that it is apparently unrealistic for the world to stop using fossil fuels. It's unrealistic to press for regulations that would prevent huge corporations like Coca-Cola and Gillette from packaging their products in plastic, which apparently no country wants to pay to actually recycle. Because, of course, according to the dominating worldview, we have to be able to make a profit in order to justify doing anything. But if we keep allowing ourselves to believe that massive change in our economy, in our laws, in our regulations isn't realistic, what kind of reality will our children and their children inherit from us? The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. famously wrote, There are certain things in our nation and in the world about which I am proud to be maladjusted, and which I hope all men of goodwill will be maladjusted. A country that forces the people to bail out industry without providing adequate social, health, and educational services, let alone protecting our elections. Now that is something to which I believe we ought to be maladjusted. The idea that fossil fuels must be all used up before humanity will be willing to change its energy consumption habits, that I believe is something to which we ought to be maladjusted. And the list goes on. But how do we cope with what is becoming the new normal while still resisting it, while refusing to normalize it? How do we find the courage and the stamina to face the reality of the climate crisis with our eyes wide open? How do we find the courage to let go of the dominant worldview and embrace slower living, smaller living, sustainable living? First, I believe we need the courage to face the reality of our planet's current trajectory. Even if all countries agreed to the Paris Agreement today, the impact of humanity's past carbon emissions would still continue to impact our climate far into the future. With this in mind, environmental science and writing teacher Alyssa Hull has this to say about facing the future. I'm inspired by so many members of this upcoming generation. They are waking up far faster and banding together with far more bravery than I and my fellow millennials did. But I suspect that some still are understandably afraid to engage, to recognize that climate change is here, that it will change their lives, is to accept the end of those lives. And it is an end to a certain way of living, to a certain mindset. But it is not the end. We need the stories to carry them, us, beyond there. When I look at my children, I don't want to think about the climate that they and their children will live in 50 years from now. I don't particularly want to admit that things will likely be more dire for them than they are for us today. But I don't think I'm serving their best interest by avoiding thinking about that. Our children need us to find the courage to prepare them for the world that they will live in. We can never undo all of the damage humans have done to this planet. We can't get back to Eden. We can never go back to the way things were. And in fact, the way things were is the problem. So our children need us to strive for a new way of being, a different way of being. And in order to do that, we need the courage to do what we know must be done, even when it's hard, even when it feels impossible or unrealistic or hopeless. Adrian Marie Brown writes, "When I feel hopeless, it usually means my attention is on things I can't touch. When I bring my attention to the people and places I can touch, can shape and be shaped by, my life fills with meaning, connection, joy, and transformation." One of the most powerful ideas I learned in seminary is that the only person in a community any of us has the power to change is ourselves. Even though we may encounter resistance at first, if we continue to live with integrity, to stick to the change that we made, eventually the community will align itself around us in a healthier way. Already, people around the world are beginning to avoid air travel as a common mode of transportation because of the fuel that it takes. Already, people are turning to no-waste stores for cleaning and beauty products without plastic packaging. I wonder what other choices we each could make that would be both better for the earth and send an economic message to the powers that be. Don Danby lives in Oakland, California, and has spent 20 years working in sustainable technology and design. When asked about the most important things we can do in the fight for the earth, she invites people to get out into nature, to fall in love with the earth. She once said, "I have the rationale around this that it's very hard to defend what you don't love." If we are to be holders of the dream of a transformed world, a different future, let that dream be rooted in our love for our Mother Earth, for we will defend what we love. Just as important as guarding our hearts against hopelessness, as defending what we love, is nourishing ourselves, feeding our spirits, tending to the needs of our hearts. When asked in an interview how the challenges facing her generation differ from those faced by other leaders in the civil rights and women's and labor movements, Adrienne Marie Brown responded this way: "I would say the biggest difference is we've increased our exposure to all the suffering and struggle in the world without increasing our capacity to handle it. The speed of knowledge has increased. Now it's a nearly instantaneous flow of crisis, tragedy, and need, sprinkled with glimpses of triumph, resilience, and humanity. And we are supposed to have a coherent opinion on all of it and stay focused on all of the things we can impact. We need mindfulness practice to come with our smartphones." Mindfulness practice to come with our smartphones is not exactly the phrase I expect to hear from an environmental activist. And yet it points, I think, to exactly the kind of daily practice needed to cultivate the seeds of a transformed world within, to be courageous while staying soft and human, staying kind and loving in this often harsh and broken world. Whatever it is that renews your hope, whatever it is that renews your spirit, however you reconnect with the places and people and values that matter most to you, please make time for these things, now more than ever. We will need strong and nourished hearts and minds, bodies and spirits, to guard against hopelessness, to prepare our children for the world they will inherit, to know deeply that we are free, and to continue to move and shape the world accordingly. And we will need to be in love with the earth if we are to protect it. Because the solution to climate change is not going to come with some new technological development that turns plastic into fish food, and it isn't going to come from some new clean fuel breakthrough. The solutions to climate change will come only when we learn to overcome ourselves. They will come when we return to the ancient teachings about the destructive power of greed and the corrupting influence of wealth. They will come when we remember that we must lose this world in order to find the next one. And they will come when we remember in our very bones the truth that every catastrophe is personal, that all people are our people, and that the whole wide earth is our home. Thank you. Does anyone have any comments or questions? I know that was a lot to throw at you.
I'm going to make one quick suggestion. I don't know if people know about it, but in Albany, near Beverages and More, in the Atrium Building, there's a shop called Feel Good. Mm-hmm. not feel good, but feel good. And you can buy bar shampoo as well as bar soaps, and you can get take your own containers in and get liquid shampoos and detergents and soaps, and you can get non-plastic cleaning utensils. And you can also get it online. So, it's right here in our back door, and it's great.
Where is that?
In Albany, in the atrium building, next to Beverages and More.
Okay. Yeah, they also have, I tried several years ago, I had some friends and colleagues who for Lent, as a practice, they tried to give up all plastic. And about 3 days into Lent, we talked with one another and none of us had been able to do it. Like, it was that hard. And Feel Good and other no-waste stores like that, they provide some of the products that I think it's hardest to find without plastic, things like deodorant, liquid shampoos and conditioners. Like, you can bring your own containers to fill with some things. And I know there are some health food stores that actually offer the same thing, and like buying food in bulk where you can bring your own containers rather than rely on packaging by the producer.
So, are there any questions?
And I want to just acknowledge that I don't think that I don't think this is something we ever really arrive at. Like, I don't think any of us can live pure lives in this society, in this economy. I think it's impossible to do that. But I think that in order to sustain the kind of courage and stamina that we need to resist the pieces of the world that are harmful, living with integrity and aligning our practices and our behaviors with our values is the only way that we can, like, live into life abundant, as Jesus would call it, you know, while also living in the real world.
Hi, I'm Reverend Earl Cotine, and I used to be a member of this congregation, though I've been affiliated with the Berkeley Fellowship now for many years. I have a full-time ministry of environmental justice, and lately I've been focusing more and more on economic and political justice, because without those two, we're not going to succeed. I'm really grateful that you cited David Wallace Wells, because like Diogenes, I had been looking for an honest person. And he certainly qualifies. He principally writes for the New York magazine, not the New Yorker, but the New York magazine. And for those who have the stamina, his book, The Uninhabitable Earth, is probably the most honest portrayal of what we're in right now and what we're headed for. I'm very glad that you used the word courage. Because too often the word hope means wishful thinking. But I would like to hear you say a little more about, you know, using less plastic and putting solar on your roof and buying a Prius, all the nice things that us upper middle class white folk can do are not really available to many of the people living in Richmond where they're every day being poisoned by Chevron.
Exactly.
And for those who are interested in systemic change, because individual virtue is not going to cut this. It's a good thing, but it's not going to cut this.
Absolutely.
I'll be around after this is over, and I'll probably volunteer to do one of these myself on March 15th.
Great.
Thank you.
So I could not agree with you more. Adrienne Marie Brown writes a blog, and one of her more recent blog posts, I can't remember the title of it, but she basically talks about, environmentalism is so often framed in white upper middle class terms. when it is a completely broadly human issue. And so I think that critique to environmentalism is really important for people like us to wrestle with. I took a lot of heat a couple years ago when I preached. No, it was more than a couple years ago now. But there was some article out. It was the first, I think, of its kind that basically said, you know, I would rather put my energy into affecting systemic change rather than, like, figuring out all the places I need to go to get plastic-free deodorant, right? Like, right. And I agree with that. I agree. We need top-down change because the vast majority of carbon emissions come from industry. They don't come from individuals turning their heat on in the winter. And I know for myself, it is exhausting to do the work of advocacy, and it is all too easy to burn out. And I think that that's why personal practice, not only getting rid of plastic and using solar panels if we're privileged enough to be able to afford that. But doing what we can where we are is more about tending to ourselves, I think. That's more about aligning our lives with what we believe is right in the ways that we are able to do that as a sustaining practice for engaging with the work of changing systems. Does that make sense?
Yeah, this is definitely a both and situation.
Yeah.
But I think very much in terms of there is so much environmental injustice within the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And we are right next door to Richmond and some of the others. We have a whole refinery corridor running from Richmond to up to Benicia,
mm-hmm.
that to become engaged locally is relatively easy and probably will be more significant mm-hmm. to not only making the future good for your children, but for mine as well.
Yeah. I mean, I will get to other questions, but I was really struck when the year that Christian and I moved here, it was 2016, and there was an issue before the Berkeley City Council, and it had to do with a affordable housing unit for the elderly that the Pacific School of Religion wanted to be able to let a developer build. And the overwhelming message that I got from that meeting was that people were more concerned with how that would impact their view out of their window than they were concerned about the actual human beings who don't have a place to live. So, to be quite honest, I don't even know where to start if that's our baseline. I don't even know where to start. So it's appalling to me, quite frankly. So I have lived in far more conservative communities than this that have cared better for their elders. So I don't know where to start that conversation, to be quite honest.
I, as you were talking about the need to limit ourselves and our inability, or how hard it is to do that, mm-hmm. I flashed back on a line from John Winthrop's sermon
mm-hmm.
390 years ago, that in order to avoid the shipwreck of the community of Boston, which they were about to found, they would need to abridge ourselves of our superfluities.
Mm-hmm. And these are not new ideas.
No.
By any stretch.
And as one of the branches descended from those Puritans, we as Unitarians on the Unitarian side, it makes me wonder. Of course, the Puritans never succeeded in abridging themselves of their superfluities. But they did, in a way that will sound strange to Unitarian ears, have the advantage of seeing themselves as sinful.
Mm-hmm.
in ways that we don't. And I wonder theologically what that mindset has to do either positively or negatively with the challenge that we face.
I so appreciate that question. Yeah. UUs don't like to talk about sin. And yet, we see the impact of it everywhere, you know, in our world. And I think that understanding, I mean, that's sort of how I have actually come to try to frame the theological idea of sin in a systemic sense. Like, I mean, just to be clear, I don't buy into the idea of original sin. Like, just let's take that frame and discard it for the conversation. I do, however, think that there is a reality, there is a real dynamic of human beings, for whatever reason, tending to go against our own best interests sometimes. Like, we have this human tendency, particularly in groups, to pursue the short-term gain despite the long-term loss, if that makes sense. And we've seen that in the housing market crisis. We've seen that, you know, in individuals making decisions about their own lives. I think that thinking about sin in a systemic sense can be really helpful because, like, none of us were born and, you know, became self-aware and said, you know what I'd like to do? I would like to destroy the planet. I think I'm going to live in ways that are going to destroy, you know, the home that I live in. We all inherit the mistakes and the successes of the ancestors that came before us. And so, but I think part of what we struggle with is getting out of a very Western sense of, like, blame about, you know, whether or not this was our fault. Like, that's completely irrelevant, I think. I think that we have to get into a different way of thinking about responsibility and about how we can be part of living into a different world, if that is helpful.
Oh, thank you, thank you. your comment about that Pacific School of Religion wanting to put buildings for people who need it, and the Berkeley response was dramatic. The problem that I'm seeing is that the low-income folks haven't been talked about, and they can barely survive, and so this climate change topic, which is 20 years in the future, doesn't affect them. So my feeling is that somehow we've got to couple it with how to get help for the low-income folks. So I think that's where the revolution mm-hmm. has to start, and I'm just curious what your thought is. How to, you know, your comment about plastics.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the U.S. is hardly the worst offender on that front. So, yeah. I know. So I think that one of the big ideas that I didn't speak to explicitly is the idea that all oppressions are linked, that Bell Hooks wrote about this in a book in 1984. So the idea that all of the isms, racism, sexism, that all of it is linked together. And I think that So Adrienne Marie Brown herself is not an upper white middle class activist. And so I have intentionally rooted my lecture and my sermon in her words because I think it's important to, I think that poor and marginalized people, are often the people who have the clearest sense of how to move forward in a meaningful and helpful way. And I think that it's important to be students for us, for me, to be a student of their work and their perspective. And so when, I mean, she, I think it was... Angela Davis wrote the phrase that optimism is a political act. And so a lot of the people of color who I read, who are environmental activists and other activists in other other areas, talk a lot about tending to the self and living one's life with integrity in the ways that are available to us, that itself is a form of resistance, and that itself is a form of activism. And so that's part of what I was trying to bring into this conversation.
Any other questions?
You know, I agree that the human selfishness and greed, it affects... Let's say it affects the climate, but it affects a lot of other things, too.
Absolutely.
And, you know, when there's so much... The problem with the whole conversation, I think, is when there's so much earth-based spirituality and socialist economics associated with the whole discussion of climate change, that tunes out a lot of people. People are not into earth-based spirituality or socialist economics. Just very suspicious of what's promoting this whole discussion of climate change because there's so much politics and spirituality or earth-based spirituality associated with it. And I think that's part of the problem.
I wouldn't agree with that.
Yeah. It's so... Anyway, but I can understand why people are suspicious because of that.
Okay. So, I mean, I went to a Methodist seminary and did a lot of biblical study, and I studied Hebrew. And one of the things, you know, and I grew up in a community with a lot of Jewish and Christian friends. And so I will say my earth focus in my own theology is largely informed by the Bible. And so it's interesting. It's just interesting to hear that. I mean, if we look at Jewish holidays, so many of them are season based. You know, there's a holiday about planting trees. So I'm not really sure what an integrated spirituality and theology without respect for the earth looks like. And so however we want to frame that with whatever theological words or stories that inform our understanding of our relationship with the earth, I think the underlying idea that we are in symbiotic relationship with the earth, like that's science. The idea of being stewards of the earth, right, that's not the same as plundering the earth, that we're called to be good stewards of the gifts that we receive. And I think that there have been perversions of the Bible for hundreds of years that have led humanity to the powerful in humanity to embrace the pieces of scripture that legitimize use of power to oppress others, the sort of kingship sources in the Bible versus what we see over and over again in the biblical witness, which is, the God of Abraham having a preferential option for the poor and taking the side of the poor and the marginalized, Hagar in the wilderness, for example. So I guess I don't see a conflict between earth-based spirituality and that worldview and how it informs environmentalism and Jewish and Christian and Muslim understandings of how we are part of the earth and the earth being something that we're called to respect. So.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Hi.
So, going forward here with UUCB congregation, the people, and the physical building, mm-hmm. do you have particular ideas or goals or things that we can do that you envision for us here as a community and as a building?
So that is not my area of expertise. the things that I know about, we already have solar here. I know that Tess is currently working, as she's trying to revive the efforts to become a green sanctuary congregation, and there are lots of like benchmarks and things that we would need to meet along the way in order to do that. And I think that that effort, that initiative, will help move us in the right direction. I think that the reality of aging buildings is that they're inherently not very efficient. And so that's going to be a challenge that we're going to need to grapple with. But much in the same way that, we had earthquake, what is it called when you retrofitting? There have to be solutions out there that we can consider for this building that would help us, help us move in the right direction. It also helps that we don't need air conditioning here. So, yeah. So I am going to say I have about 5 more minutes before I need to leave and start preparing for the service.
Any other questions?
I'd like to kind of explore the dualism mm-hmm. in the ecology argument. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with New Age versus traditional religion. Mm-hmm. And it also has to do with the concept of sin, I think. Mm-hmm. I totally rejected original sin, and then I changed my mind. Mm-hmm. I decided instead of just rejecting things that had problems, I'd try to see the other side. Mm-hmm. And I found some legitimacy in the other side. To me, original sin has meaning because it's talking about selfishness. Mm. How can a little baby, an innocent baby, have original sin? Because we're born selfish, thinking of ourselves and our needs, and that's the immediate survival mm-hmm. instinct. That's how we survive being a baby, mm-hmm. is keeping our eye on the essential stuff, mm-hmm. which is, am I getting fed and am I getting taken care of? So when you think about original sin as selfishness, it's not about evil versus mm-hmm. good. It's about, well, maybe we're too self-involved, or maybe the media is both good and bad because although it gets us together, we don't touch each other when mm-hmm. we're using media. And so all that touching and realizing how important our environment is mm-hmm. Goes by the wayside. So the ecofeminism and ideas like Starhawk's about power is, and also Joseph Campbell, I'm an eclectic. Everything is connected to everything else. If you follow your bliss, if you do something locally that you love, that doesn't drain you of energy, that's better for the whole world situation than to fly out to Washington, D.C. and going on a march mm-hmm. and using money, resources, and energy and for a couple of hours on the street. So to me, the dualism in all this, the rich and poor kinds of things, if we worry about plastic instead of our neighbor who doesn't have enough to eat, does that make sense? I think we have to stop thinking dualistically and the infamous polarity where people who believe in traditional religion is bad and new wave people are bad and everybody except people who think exactly like mm-hmm. me, very suspicious people. Mm-hmm. There's something a little off.
I agree. Thank you so much for that comment.
Could I add something to that? In listening to you in this and following up, William Barber and Liz Theo Harris, Poor People's Campaign, Reverend Max's, or I guess it was Stan about, he terms it people of low wealth. Anyway, read about Poor People's Campaign now that's being revivified. We are involved with that here. If people want to get more involved, come and see me or just go online, Poor People's Campaign. It's revivified by William Barber and Liz Theo Harris.
Mm-hmm. One more?
Sure.
One more question. Is there somebody over here? Was there somebody over here I missed earlier?
Oh, I just wanted to comment.
Okay.
So if you want to know more about retrofitting this building and doing other things like that, you have a resident expert here, Abbott Foote. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, probably the best thing this place could do, and maybe you've done it since I was last here, is buy a van and have a shuttle service from BART.
Christian and I have dreamed about this ever since we got here.
Okay. I mean, I look at the average age of the people in this room, and I think of all the young adults I work with who don't have cars mm-hmm. and will probably never get up here until we make it... Mm-hmm. If they can afford Lyft and Uber.
Right.
Right. But I'm right. just saying, that would make a big difference.
Last question.
Good morning. I just want to make a comment that the gentleman sparked. There is a significant voting population that believes that the proper goal is Armageddon and, you know,
The what is Armageddon?
Apocalypse.
Oh, got it. Okay.
And so there is a disconnected spirituality out there. There's a sort of cultural war between the sort of non-connected theism with the humanism. Mm-hmm. So, but anyhow, that's just an observation he sparked.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's absolutely true. And I guess so often Unitarian Universalists think of ourselves as, unique, completely unique. And I think, I mean, in some way, every denomination is unique. But we have a lot more in common than I think we have a lot of allies in the work, and that there are many religious traditions and streams of religious traditions that have similar values around respecting the earth as something that we are in relationship with, rather than simply something to extract profit from. And I think that a lot of my colleagues have been talking about wondering if the next 50 years are going to be the death of denominations. And, you know, we see fractures beginning to form in a number of denominations around some issues like LGBT ordination and rights, rejection of the idea that, you know, white supremacy is a problem, things like that. And so I think that I find that an interesting idea. You know, I have a lot of colleagues in UCC, Lutheran, Presbyterian churches who, when you look at the way that they live their lives, it is so similar, you know, to the lifestyles and the values of people in this church. They just have very different religious language than I do. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you, Reverend Kristen, and
thank you.
Thanks to everyone for coming.